You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Okay, everyone, welcome to our panel. We will be conducting the panel in Spanish. So underneath your seats, should you require translation in English, there are headsets. Please set it to channel number 2 for the English translation. Yeah? Y para las personas que requieran traducción en español, por favor utilicen los audífonos al canal número 10, por favor. ¿Sí? Habrá traducción en ambas lenguas, en español y en inglés.
There will be interpretation into both languages, both English and Spanish.
Welcome
to this session addressing educational barriers for Afro-Peruvian girls. We already heard Eliana's presentation this morning. Now I'd like to introduce our panelists. You already have the bios as part of your symposium agenda, but I'd like to introduce them individually, starting with Eliana Villar Márquez, who is an Echidna Global Scholar at the Brookings Institution here and a sociologist from Peru. Thank you for being here, Eliana. We also have with us Lilia Mayorga Balcazar, who's a communications specialist at CEDET. She came yesterday from Lima to be able to join us today. Welcome, Lilia. And lastly, we have Ingrid Sanchez Tapia, an education specialist in gender equality in education at UNICEF. She has come from New York to join us today. Welcome, Ingrid. I'm Josie Ramos. I work with Rise Up in Oakland, California. I will be the moderator for this panel, and I'm going to channel my internal Oprah Winfrey to see if we can't have a really deep, fruitful discussion today. So thank you very much. So let us begin. The first question is for Eliana. In your presentation today, you told us about the dire situation for Afro-Peruvian minorities, specifically girls. We know that Peru, like many other Latin American countries, is a quite diverse country with lots of different ethnic groups. So what makes this group different from other minority groups? Good afternoon to everyone. Thank you for being here. I'm glad you've come to listen to this panel discussion in Spanish. First, I'd like to say that this research has been a very intense experience for me as I learned specifically about the Afro-Peruvian population in my country. The main reason why I wanted to study this issue in particular and made this proposal to the Echidna Scholar Program is because for many years I've been working on gender equality issues and childhood and poverty for 25 years. And every time we issued reports or conducted research on gender gaps, I found it was very difficult to find information on the Afro-Peruvian population. And I wondered why. Why is there so little information, and why is the information that does exist so scattered and sometimes even contradictory? So all of that led me to this conceptual framework of differentiating between race and ethnicity. It's an issue that has to be tackled. It's an important conceptual discussion that has to be had so we can lay the groundwork for a discussion of ethnic and racial discrimination. So the issue is basically quite straightforward. Races have to do with physical features and phenotypes, while ethnicity is a more comprehensive category because it encompasses culture, cultural heritage of families. And science has taught us that race really doesn't exist in the world anymore. We have a wide range of people that fall along different places on the human spectrum. But unfortunately, this is not part of what people call common sense. Even educated people, or very educated people, may know that race is not a useful term. It doesn't really mean anything, but that's something that needs to be extended. There needs to be a more awareness of that. So to your question, why this group is often more vulnerable than indigenous groups is because there's no information about black Peruvians. And when there is a lack of information, that's when speculation happens. Myths, legends. People throw out ideas as to why the conditions are what they are, but why there's not a single Afro-Peruvian representative in Congress, or why opinions are what they are. I personally don't recall knowing Afro-Peruvians when I was young. So why is it that way? It's not an accident. For many decades in Peru, the Afro-Peruvian population was kept invisible for reasons that I explained before. For decades, the concept of ethnicity and gathering data with an ethnicity focus was limited by language. That was the division that was used. There were people who spoke Spanish and people who spoke other languages like Quechua, Aymara, and that was what was used to distinguish the white groups versus indigenous groups. That is a factor that has contributed to making this group invisible, and that has made them much more vulnerable than we might have imagined. Thank you so much, Eliana. I would like all of the panelists, Lilia, Ingrid, and Eliana, to talk to us about how they came to their work, what has brought you to where you are now. And Ingrid and Lilia could perhaps share their initial reactions from Eliana's response and presentation, starting with Ingrid. Good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me well? To start, as Josie was saying, I am a specialist in gender equality and education at UNICEF, which involves quite a commitment on the part of UNICEF to look at gender equality in education, ensuring the level playing field for all children in education. So this mandate, this idea of a human right of quality education with gender equality is what has brought me here. And it is closely related to the work being done by Eliana. As she said, in Peru, historically, certain ethnic and racial groups were not duly recognized in the census, for instance, or in the data compiled by the Ministry of Education, and that made their needs invisible and made it impossible to formulate evidence-based strategies to help them. Pro-equity strategies. It makes it harder to understand the differences between groups, between boys and girls, between men and women. That is why the work Eliana is doing comes at such an opportune time in Peru's sociopolitical landscape, because this kind of research is informing a better categorization of ethnic identity. And in the last census, we saw new efforts to include this category of Afro-Peruvians. It's included in a national household survey, for instance. Peru has historically had intercultural educational strategies, and with these new findings, they will be broadened to encompass other groups. We said ethnic identification happened based on language, and now it will expand and be culturally based as well, and based on traditions. So this is a timely report, and it is very fortunate that it will be available to inform the discourse and ensure that evidence-based science is used to advance the right to quality education for girls who are living in a more marginalized situation because they belong to an ethnic group or live in a rural setting or live in poverty. Thank you. Lilia, could you talk to us about how you came to do the work that you do now and reflect a bit on what Eliana shared with us? Thank you. Good afternoon. First of all, thank you to Brookings for having invited us and for having, and to Eliana for having taken the time to do research and exploring barriers for Afro-Peruvian girls. As we know, there's almost no information on Afro-Peruvians. As an Afro-Peruvian myself, I work in an NGO that works on human rights issues, and I work specifically on girls through the Palenque Infantil program for Afro-Peruvian children and adolescents in marginal neighborhoods of Lima, though we also work in northern Peru, specifically in Yapatera, which is the place where Eliana conducted her research, and I very much appreciate that. She really captures the situation for Afro-Peruvian girls. But I'd like to emphasize the issue of the barriers, specifically the racism and discrimination barriers that Afro-Peruvian girls face. Peru is one of the most racist countries. I've lived this myself, experienced it. CEDET, the Center for Ethnic Development where I work, has been working on these issues for 19 years now. We are no longer called blacks, we're called Afro-Peruvians or Afro-descendants. Before, we were just blacks. After the Third World Discussion on Racial Discrimination in Durban, it was declared for the first time that the states parties must address the issue of Afro-descendants. The Peruvian Toledo administration developed the Peruvian Institute for Amazonian Indigenous and Afro-Peruvian Affairs. INDEPA no longer exists because Alan Garcia's administration dissolved it. He showed no interest in this group. The only thing he did do was recognize the fact that we were historical victims of the scourge of slavery. Now, today we have the Ministry of Culture, and within that, there is a department that does work on Afro-Peruvian affairs. It's a bureau of the Ministry of Culture. And there is the DEPA plan, the development plan for Afro-Peruvians. It is a plan that's just on paper, has not been implemented yet because the state lacks the resources to implement it. But this plan does not really address issues faced by girls. So all these issues faced by Afro-Peruvian girls in the area of education, which brings us here, aside from gender inequality and poverty and other issues, one of those barriers, one of the worst, is racism. The racism these girls face because they are girls, because they are black, because they are poor. So that is a multifaceted racism that makes them victims and blocks their access to many things to which they ought to have a right. So CEDED, through the Palenque program, has sought to contribute somehow to reducing these barriers and gaps, preventing girls from realizing those rights that every human being should have. Yapetera is a place I know. When I first came to CEDED, I was impressed. I'm from the north, from a community called Sanya, close to Chiclayo, with many Afro-Peruvians, and Yapetero is in the north too, in Piura, and it has 6,000 inhabitants. And its infrastructure, and I promise to wrap up with this, is minimal, because we're not just talking about access to education, we're talking about quality, and the infrastructure is a major problem, but we'll talk about it later. Thank you, Lilia. I did want to give Eliana the opportunity to talk to us briefly about how she came to do the work she does. Well, actually, my path was quite long. I worked for a long time on childhood poverty issues, childhood issues in general, but I above all consider myself to be a specialist in gender equality. And I specialize in research that applies gender analysis. I think that's very important, and we need to make the differences between men and women, boys and girls, more visible in my country. The original proposal that I submitted to the ECIDNA program was much more ambitious. It included learning about education for Afro-Peruvians and also education for Amazonian indigenous girls. Those are the blind spots, as you say. There was no light being shed on what is happening with these populations. Now, owing to a number of problems in the country, amongst them, the fact that the government is very centralized in the population, also a third of the country lives in Lima, and quality of services outside of Lima is very limited. So, in trying to carry out the proposal, the program, and I realized that I might be biting off more than I can chew, and we wouldn't be able to address both issues at the same time. So I decided to begin by addressing the Afro-Peruvian girls first, and I say first because I do still intend to study access to education for Amazonian indigenous girls. I hope to do that research soon. I believe that those of us who have a chance to hold the mic, have a voice, have an audience like this, if we don't do something to disseminate information on those populations living in the shadows, nobody else is going to do it, and nobody will know what their plight is. So I believe that these 5 months that I've been living in Washington, D.C. have been worth it from many standpoints. Yes, I'm far away from home and my family and my country, and that has been difficult, but it's been important to do that so that I could have this product that will do something to shed a light on the Afro-Peruvian populations. Thank you, Eliana. I'd like to turn to Ingrid now and have her talk to us a little bit, because I know in your work with UNICEF, data play a vital role in identifying gaps between populations in the countries where you work. What have you found in your work, not just in Peru, but across Latin America, as regards the invisibility of minority groups? What data are being collected, and what's missing? What are the gaps? What data are still needed? Thank you, Josie. Generally, in Latin America, it's common for the ministries of education to have statistical planning units or even independent statistical education statistics units that use very good data collection techniques. The data are robust, but the data are not always available to researchers. They are used for policy making. Very useful for checking data and disaggregation to identify vulnerable groups, but that part is much harder, and it depends on the country. Now, specifically in Peru, the fact that the category Afro-Peruvians did not exist meant that the information wasn't being collected. And at most, there might be some scattered data and individual studies done by think tanks or universities, but they weren't comparable with the data being collected by government institutions or the ministries of education. So it is being increasingly recognized that data collection on ethnic groups is important. One of the challenges at this time is that the availability of data shouldn't just be available data. It needs to actually, they need to be used to inform public policy, to identify who's being left behind in terms of access to quality education and learning. So the data that need to be collected first of all, access is what's collected most. That's what motivates the ministries. They don't want children, boys and girls, outside of the system. They want coverage, especially in an area that consists mainly of middle-income countries, which is the case of Peru and the Mercosur countries. They all want to be part of the OECD. And it doesn't look good if there are children that aren't going to school, but we need to go beyond that. We don't have disaggregated data on learning. Even though there are, in all Latin American countries, there are learning assessments on reading and math, sometimes science, in both primary and secondary school. And those data need to be disaggregated, but beyond just girls and boys. It's hard to detect whether there are ethnic disparities or regional disparities, so we know who's not learning, who's being left behind. And girls, in many cases, given all the gender discrimination and gender norms which influence how they are taught, are the ones that are learning less. And we need the hard data so we can say, okay, we need strategies to support teachers to do a better job in these areas. And it has been very hard, not just in Latin America, but across the world, to gather data, and especially on violence, gender violence in the schools. That's another gap. It needs to go beyond kids scoring well on tests. They need to be in safe environments to be able to learn, and environments that have gender violence where girls don't feel safe, they end up falling behind in a very short period of time. They lose up to 1.7 years of learning over primary and secondary school, but we don't have all the data. It's hard to gather, and that's where governments and researchers should start working together to get the data and be able to continue to improve educational quality for girls, especially minority and rural girls who do suffer discrimination and violence in the school environment. Thank you, Lilia. I'd like to continue with you. You already talked a bit about your work with Afro-Peruvian girls in different communities. How do you think that these data gaps that exist nationally and globally affect grassroots efforts to improve girls' lives? And what are the opportunities that might open up if we manage to bring more visibility to these communities? Thank you. The lack of data is a problem we've been facing since the outset of our work. In 2017, we had the first census that authorized the National Statistics Institute to include ethnicity as a variable. The last time that was included was over 40 years ago. So there were 40 years where that wasn't captured. There are about 3 million Afro-Peruvians. Children's education in Peru is terrible. There's a lot of discrimination in that setting. It is a major factor that undermines girls' self-esteem. In working with girls close up, we've heard reports of children, girls who didn't want to go to school anymore because of the ethnically based abuse that they are suffering. Race may not exist scientifically, but it continues to be used to make us feel like we're worth less than others. teachers don't know how to address the issue of racism and discrimination, and they'll say, oh, it's just kids playing. But we all know that children can be cruel and they cause harm. There are cases of girls who didn't want to go to school anymore. Their performance suffered because it was impossible to learn in a setting where they're excluded, ignored, neglected by their classmates and the teachers. Public policies, which have not really been developed for girls, the Ministry of Education and of Culture are trying to formulate public policies. But if the government doesn't have the political will to do something, we're going to remain invisible. Afro-Peruvians have been made invisible for a long time, and it prevents access to basic services. Going back to Yapatera just recently got safe drinking water. A few years ago, electricity. But when I went, the town didn't have safe drinking water or drainage or electricity, and the school situation was terrible. These girls don't know how to access the internet because their schools don't have computers. Or they'd have a computer, but not electricity, because the government decided to give them computers and forgot that they run on the electricity. Thank you. Thank you, Lilia.
Gracias. Eliana, me gustaría seguir contigo. Un gran tema que vemos en tu trabajo es la interseccionalidad, o sea, cómo las identidades sociales de cada persona intersectan
interact at different levels simultaneously. Why is it important in the Peruvian context to look at not only race, ethnicity, or gender, but also to look at other dimensions of identity? Well, that's really key. That's really the core of the research that I've tried to carry out all these months. On top of bringing or shedding some light on the importance of having data, of high quality data, the fact or rather, the situation of Afro-Peruvian girls is the result of a very complex situation, different types of discrimination that converge. They're girls, they're poor, they're black. Like Lilia mentioned just a second ago, and because of this, discrimination is much more extreme. It's much more excluding in general. And I would like to provide you with a very specific example. On top of this, there is a series of stigmas and a series of different types of prejudice and beliefs that is beginning to affect the common sense of the population. They're starting to think that those things are true. For example, Lilian was talking about just games, you know, where children give a nickname to another child, and it seems like a very innocent type of game, but it actually really undermines self-esteem and the identity of people. One of the deepest types of prejudice regarding Afro-descendants in Peru is that they're not very smart. And that is key when it comes to education, because that actually has a serious impact on the perception that adults have regarding these girls and boys and their performance. If, for example, I'm receiving all type of signals telling me that these children are not very smart and that no matter what I do, they will never have a good academic performance, I will eventually believe it. So I think that we really need to work on these issues from the get-go. Something else, I think that in the specific case of Afro-Peruvian girls, there's something that is key, and it's a hyper sexual approach of Afro-Peruvian girls. Basically, it is said that Afro-Peruvian girls are much more sexual, and it has nothing to do with reality, actually. And they're told that that's their destiny, in other words, to worry about their physical appearance, about their bodies, and eventually they need to learn how to dance, because black girls need to know how to dance, and black boys need to know how to play soccer. That's the stigma regarding the roles, the stereotypical roles that these children receive since they're very young. And if that is the case, at some point you don't think about any other options apart from the options that society has decided for you. And I think that's what intersectionality is. A whole series of factors that mean that discrimination is much deeper and much harder to eradicate. Thank you. Ingrid? Or, well, before I go, I offer the floor to Ingrid. I don't know if anyone here has any other comments regarding what has just been said. Well, Ingrid, I actually wanted to ask you about whether you think this intersectionality approach is being used globally in order to analyze the data. And also, what type of change you think involves if you look at the situation through this lens, or how organizations would address the barriers that currently exist. Intersectionality is not a new concept, but it's taken a while until it's been taken into account when collecting data or when informing public policy or about what population needs to benefit from this public policy. In this regard, when we talk about gender equality in education or education for girls, we see that intersectionality is very important. It's understood and it's actually applied. Many international organizations, such as UNICEF, international cooperation, the United Kingdom, Canada, they understand this very clearly, this concept of intersectionality based on data is key in order to identify those girls that need the greatest support to have access to high-quality education. However, when we are talking about other communities, such as the data collecting community or those that collect information about learning, they do not really have the same approach, and they don't really understand what an intersectional approach involves when it comes to measuring learning and education, because sometimes you need new techniques, new efforts. Let me give you an example. The PISA testing, they give us a lot of information about teenagers in terms of their learning. In Peru right now, they have different categories, right? So, and the sample to conclude something about regarding different groups should be representative of the different types of population. This implies technical knowledge by the government and obviously also by the OECD in order to know the type of sample that you need that will allow you to compare boys and girls, Afro-Peruvians, indigenous boys and indigenous children from the Sierra, from the rainforest, from the children surrounding urban areas. All these groups face different types of discrimination, have different needs regarding their education, and also they need different public policies. And we don't have reliable information applying this intersectional approach. Basically, they're more focused on the general population and populations that have more privileges. So those of us that are here, that are part of the stakeholders community that wants to advance education for girls and gender equality in education, it's important for us to have an active dialogue with those in charge of globally evaluating children's learning, also teenagers' education. And we need also to talk to education experts so that they use this approach and then so that budget allocation strategies can be developed for ministries of education so that they can have an impact on the public budget to make sure that public funding will reach girls that are needed the most, those are victims of marginalization. So economists need to develop new techniques that are user-friendly for the education ministries, for example. And you also need advocacy, right? Yes. Thank you, Ingrid. My next question is in general for all of you. Talking about opportunities to build public policy or formulate public policy, what is the current policy discourse on Afro-Peruvian girls' education in Peru and across Latin America in general in comparison to that of indigenous girls' education? As Ileana was saying this morning, it seems that the global education community is more focused on indigenous populations, but other populations remain invisible, such as Afro-Peruvian girls. Ileana, what do you have to say in this regard?
Thank you. Well,
thank you for your question, as I believe it's very relevant. And I want to take advantage now to talk of this opportunity to talk about opportunities. In Peru, for example, we have a very large indigenous population. In my opinion, both at a national and regional level, in Andean countries such as Bolivia or Ecuador, there is a large indigenous population, and they've managed to position this issue in their political agenda nationally and internationally. Proof of this is when we see indicators about how education completion has increased, both for indigenous boys and girls. We can compare this data. For example, in Peru, we have disaggregated data in this regard, and we can see that this is not the case for Afro-Peruvian girls. This is not an issue that is being discussed when public policy is discussed. It is true that the political situation in Peru is experiencing certain turmoil, and the situation is quite difficult when it comes to Afro-Peruvian girls, gender equality, but also for education, because they need to compete with other issues to be included in the public agenda. We are competing with other issues that are demanding attention and visibility. Here I would like to identify certain opportunities in Peru. For example, there are different programs that have to do with public education. The two programs that I mentioned during this morning's presentation, High Performance Schools and one program known as Beca 18, these are two public programs
that target extreme kids in extreme poverty, and they are performing very well, these programs. The problem is that, for example, those high-performance schools, there's one in each region, and we're talking about 25 regions in Peru, for example. These are public schools that are extremely good. They have the best teachers. They have the best facilities for the kids to actually live there Monday through Friday, and then they can go back home for the weekend. But these schools are for really outstanding kids, kids that have had outstanding performance during the first years of secondary school and the second part of secondary school. Then they can go to these very high quality schools with the best services, best standards. The problem is that in certain remote areas, in certain communities like Yapatera, I am fully convinced that it is extremely difficult for, or very unlikely, that teachers have actually informed kids about these programs. Therefore, they're less likely to apply for these programs. So then, I found disaggregated data based on sex for these schools, but I also want disaggregated data by ethnicity regarding these high performance schools. It's not only to have it's not enough to have disaggregated data in terms of gender, but countries need to have very specific public policies in place regarding the integration of their minorities. And I think that is a very specific type of measure that could be done. I don't know if here the solution is to demand a certain quota. Sometimes this has been done, and a lot of criticism comes with it regarding the merit of those that have access to that type of education. I don't have time to address this topic in depth, but basically what I do want to say is that these programs also need to be available for Afro-Peruvian girls, and it would be good to have to take specific actions, specific collaborations, for example, in order to promote this type of measure, specific efforts that will bring greater accountability by the government and also more transparent accountability. I would like now to offer the floor to Lilia for her to explain to us what she thinks about public policy and Afro-Peruvian girls. Specifically, I would like you to talk about the skills that are being developed among Afro-Peruvian girls. What are the skills that are helping these Afro-Peruvian girls to have greater opportunities in life? Well, I will address what you're asking me right now, but before I do so, I would like to talk a little bit about the two programs that my colleague just mentioned. Beca 18 had certain requirements. For example, one of the requirements was that those extremely poor families could not have cement houses, or they couldn't have a TV at home. And Afro-descendants had TVs at home, even though they were extremely poor. And then high-performance schools. Who are they competing against? Well, they are competing against children in Lima, for example. So Afro-Peruvian children in different provinces of Peru had to compete against children in Lima. The high-performance school is in Lima, in Guamaní. I visited it because I worked with the Ministry of Education, and I did not find a single Afro-Peruvian kid. So, even though there are public policies in place, Afro-Peruvians have no access to those programs. There is this other program, Palenque Infantil, and basically the program is aimed at helping these girls about, for example, citizenry or identity. if you are in denial regarding your identity because of mistreatment or discrimination, that has a serious impact on the kid. So we are developing material, different types of materials about this. What have we contributed to the Peruvian identity, we as Afro-descendants? What have been our contributions? What happens with the Afro-Peruvian diaspora? We are trying to help these girls by talking to them about leadership, about identity, about knowledge, about our fight against racism, which has to take place on a daily basis. We want them to be able to fight it. We don't want them to hide. We want them to accept their identity and fight racism. We want the government to develop specific policies to fight racism in Peru. And with all these different factors and efforts we're making, we hope we can improve the lives of Afro-Peruvian girls. I don't know if you have any comments regarding public policy. Yes. Well, before we wrap up this panel discussion, I would like to add something. I think there's a great opportunity in Peru now, given the 2016-2020 development plan for Afro-Peruvians. Civil society is highly engaged in this regard. We have researchers, and they need to encourage the national government as well as regional governments to really implement these policies that benefit Afro-Peruvian girls and to better understand their situation, their education, and actually improve it. And finally, from UNICEF, our commitment is the following. Given the new evidence, the new data, we want to support the Peruvian government so that intercultural education policies will actively include the needs of the Afro-Peruvian population. We want to be a good interlocutor between the government and Afro-Peruvians and the civil society organizations so that we can advance the rights of Afro-Peruvian girls in terms of education. Thank you. And without further ado, I would like now to move on to the Q&A session. I don't know if anyone in the audience right now has a microphone. In any case, if anyone has any questions, I would like to take two or three questions at a time, and then we will answer them all together. So if you have any questions, please raise your hand. Can I ask my question in Spanish? Of course. Hi, my name is Milagros. I'm Peruvian. In my opinion, what I'm seeing is a series of different types of discrimination at different stages. Afro-Peruvians continue to be discriminated at school, at university, and at the workplace. Different studies have proven this. However, what really called my attention regarding the data that we have about Afro-Peruvians is that one every 9 students dropping out of school. And this is a higher percentage compared to the national level. The main reason why is because they don't like to go to school. And they mentioned this reason above other reasons, such as, for example, discrimination. I guess that the main reason is discrimination, what was being talked about during the panel. But going back to what I also just mentioned, do you think there is, for example, a lack of adaptation of the academic curriculum or something else? Why Afro-Peruvian children are deciding to drop out? And then something else that we need to take into account is that maybe children, these Afro-Peruvian children, know that in the future they will not continue to study because they will face discrimination when applying for a university or when having access to a job. So maybe that also has an impact on primary education and how children approach those years of education, early years of education. Do you have any opinions in this regard? You can ask questions in Spanish or in English. I will continue to ask questions in Spanish. I'm Pablo. And my question is the following. Given all the difficulties in society, what is your personal experience? How did you overcome discrimination or lack of opportunities for Afro-Peruvians after secondary school? Are there any other questions in the audience? There in the back, the person, the woman in glasses, yes. Hi. Thank you very much. My name is Diana. I'm a consultant for the World Bank. And my question also has to do with the curriculum. What do you think about changing the mindset, or that change of mindset that we've been talking about for a while? We know that Afro-Peruvian children are facing barriers in terms of access to high-quality education. What happens with children in general? In my country, we also have an indigenous population, and we are facing the exact same problem. But I actually think it has to do with the curriculum. And I would like to mention a song that we all know, Arroz con Leche. It's Arroz con Leche, I want to marry to a woman from San Nicolás that knows how to sew, that knows how to open the door to go and play. We all know that song. I sang it 1,000 times throughout my life, and we continue to sing it. It's sung at school. How do we do it to change the curriculum? And I know this is a very political matter, but how do we do it to change that mindset that has to do with the roles that are highly rooted, the gender roles and that we have for women, for men, for children in general? Thank you very much. One last question here, the gentleman.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. The Peruvian government wants to join some organization. They want to be a part of something that in the future. So when is this inclusion that I heard Ingrid speak of, UNESCO, global eradication of uneducated and impoverished people. When do you foresee this inclusion of the Afro-Peruvians in the society, not just in education and employment, but in the overall society of Peru?
Gracias.
We have extremely interesting questions about school dropout, dropping out of school, about your personal experience too. We have another question about the curriculum and how it could be changed, it could be adapted. And finally, about inclusion of Afro-Peruvians, not only in terms of education, but also in society as a whole in Peru. Who wants to start? Thank you very much for your questions. It's quite clear that you are very interested in the issue and that you understand the gaps in the system, those cracks also where we are facing the biggest challenges. One of the things that I wanted to say is that in answering to the question asked by my Peruvian friend regarding racial discrimination and how it doesn't end at school, that's absolutely certain. And it's proven by different studies conducted in Peru. In Peru, they developed for example, curriculum vitae of people that were fake, and they used different features of black people, white people, mestizos, mixed, and the results were actually astounding. The black population are never called for high-level positions, and women are always offered lower positions with lower salaries. And when businessmen are asked, or when headhunters are asked, they say that they want to hire people like them. That's the response, and I think here we need no further comments. And regarding the other question about girls and boys dropping out of school because they don't like school, research in depth has been carried out about this issue in particular, and the most reliable interpretation of this answer has to do with the extremely poor quality public education. Someone doesn't like something when they don't think it's useful. And that's the key issue. Many boys and girls said that they don't like school. It's because it's not relevant. They think it's not relevant because they're not learning anything for their present lives or future lives. And now I would like to touch upon a couple of points that have to do with a personal experience and discrimination. During this morning's panel, someone said that discrimination could happen because of different reasons, racial discrimination or because you have a disability, and overcoming it is very difficult. It's possible, but it comes with a price. Those that survive different types of discrimination, from the most subtle ones to the most clear and open ones or types of discrimination, overcoming it has a very high emotional and psychological cost. And I think all this has to be taken into account when we are talking about overcoming discrimination. The pressure put on those people that need to overcome that type of discrimination. Finally, something that has to do with the curriculum and that I could actually identify when conducting my research. Recently, less than a year ago, in fact, the Minister of Education wanted to bring more visibility to Afro-descendants, and it was decided to recover some of the stories that showed the contributions of Afro-Peruvians to the Peruvian identity and culture.
Interestingly, the texts that were created were distributed only in areas where there were Afro-descendant populations. And if these things aren't done across the board in a cross-cutting way, it should be every Peruvian's duty to know about the historical roots of the country and the contribution of the black population to Peruvian identity. And if we don't do that, nothing will change. This task is one for everyone, not just for the Afro-Peruvians themselves. They aren't the only ones who should know about their contribution. Yes, I just quickly wanted to add to what Eliana was saying. It's true that the curricula don't reflect the realities of Afro-Peruvians. We've provided information so that the state could include it. Brazil does have a good curriculum that talks about Afro-Brazilians. Peru has work to do because it is not just Afro-Peruvians that need to learn about this. Society as a whole needs to learn it so that society will respect our population and what they've contributed. Children, I don't think it's that children don't like school. There is that stereotype that Afro-Peruvians aren't smart. Unfortunately, that's something that haunts us. But There are children that go to school and they go to the university, but even the professors won't call upon an Afro-Peruvian because they think they won't have the answer. At work, a colleague had to quit her job, and this is in the workplace, because she was consistently being teased and harassed about her race at work. This is a social reality. It pervades every space, and we deal with it. With the programs in place, we hope that society will become more aware over time. Ingrid, did you want to add anything about any of the four questions raised? Well, building upon what Eliana and Lilia said, in any society, racism is the product of complex and deep-rooted relationships. And so simplistic solutions are not going to help us move forward. We can't oversimplify and say that Afro-Peruvian boys and girls don't like school. If they are suffering discrimination and they don't see themselves represented in what is being taught, and that comes day in and day out, on top of having to face an unpleasant environment, see, if these children are also living in poverty, if they have to work to help support their families, well, then there's a cost benefit analysis, an opportunity cost, and adolescents often have to make decisions as to how they can support their families, and that's a dynamic you see in the U.S. and in countries all over the globe. So we can't say they don't like school. There needs to be curriculum-related work, yes. There are countries that have fantastic curricula, though, on paper, but they must be taught by teachers, and those teachers are not always aware of their own inherent biases or that they might be discriminating. And so there has to be an intentional, deep effort made to improve the educational system. How many black women do we see in leadership positions in Latin America's education ministries or in Peru? I'm sure I could count them on one hand. It's not common. How many black women do we see in the role of physics or chemistry professors or secondary teachers? An Afro-Peruvian girl is not going to have a lot of opportunities to see the model, to what they can aspire to. So it's much more than just having the curriculum on paper. Yes, that is a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient. We have to work on societal gender norms and tackle the discrimination. And on the other question, Peru is, and I'm not Peruvian, but my colleagues might have a better answer as they are, but Peru is it officially now an OECD member? Not yet? Okay, so then Peru is continuing to try to join the OECD, which is basically the community of industrialized countries in the world. And there are still inequalities and gaps in Peru, as there are in other Latin American countries. As an international organization, UNICEF supports the Peruvian government, provides technical assistance so that those barriers can be removed, so that inequity can be improved, and citizen groups, civil society, can also help. The government alone cannot make that kind of a move. It really is a combined effort of all. Anyone else? I'd just like to thank you all for your time, for being here, for showing such interest in the topic. There are many things that couldn't be said because time is short, but I just wanted to let you know that there are so many more things to talk about. It is really a fascinating topic, and it's of vital importance for Peru and for Latin America. I invite you to please read the report, the policy paper, which was made available in print this morning and is also available online, because I'd like that to get out. And thank you for everyone's attention. Well, I hope it is clear to everyone that data are just the first step toward understanding ethnic inequality and the situation faced by Afro-Peruvian girls. And so the challenge, as Ingrid initially stated, lies in how to disaggregate the data and translate those into policy action, how to implement policies and social programs such as the Beca 18 scholarship, and evaluate what progress is being made, because governments are increasingly making decisions based on indicators and monitoring. And if we don't have quality data and indicators, Afro-descendant and indigenous populations will continue to be left outside public policy making, as we already know. So the countries of Latin America and the world need to gather the data, monitor the indicators in order to promote equality and close the gaps, because closing them is not only good for those on the margins, in this case, Afro-Peruvian girls, but it's good for everyone. So thank you very much.